We weigh 20 more pounds than we did in the 1960s, and we've only grown an inch taller on average. And this is going to be the first generation of Americans that won't live as long of a life as their parents.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
Welcome to the show. Our guest today is Tim Ryan, the U.S. Representative for Ohio's 13th Congressional District, serving since 2003. Tim is the author of A Mindful Nation, How a Simple Practice Can Help Us Reduce Stress, Improve Performance, and Recapture the American Spirit. Tim also has a new book called The Real Food Revolution, Healthy Eating, Green Groceries, and the Return of the American Family Farm. Before we get to the interview, I did want to mention that the One You Feed podcast was recently included in iTunes Best Podcasts of 2014. Eric and I would like to thank our listeners for all the support and the dedication. So keep coming back.
Hi, Congressman Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I am really excited that we were able to get you on for a variety of reasons. One is you're an Ohioan like us. We're based in Columbus. Two is you're a congressman, which is great. And three, you are really into mindfulness, which is a big part of what we talk about on the show a lot. So I'm really glad that we were able to find a time to meet up.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And I'm glad you're pushing out the message in Ohio, because I think it's a great place for us to really transform the state with some of these ideas and practices.
Yep. So our podcast is called The One You Feed, and it's based on the parable of two wolves, where there's a grandfather who's talking with his grandson, and he says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love, and the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops for a second, and he thinks about it, and he looks up at his grandfather, and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you how that parable applies to you in your work and in your life.
Well, I think, attention and awareness practices like mindfulness help you to see what is going on inside of you, and helps you to see those emotions as they arise in you, and help you cultivate awareness so that you can see what you're thinking about. And so a lot of times you don't know which one you're feeding. You may have some delusionary idea that you're feeding one, and you're actually feeding the other. And without, I think, taking time in your day or in your life to have some contemplation, have some present moment awareness, see and spend time with the TV off and the radio off and the technology put down, so that you can actually see what's going on inside yourself, so that you can properly feed the ones that you want. And I think the work that I do with trying to get these awareness and attention practices in the schools, into the healthcare to help with veterans who are coming back with post-traumatic stress is really the first step to knowing which wolf you're going to feed. And so I think it's fundamental to living a good life and living with an intention of, you know, what you want to do and be and in your own life.
Yeah, I agree 100% that awareness is such a key thing. And one of the things that I think meditation has brought to me is the way I describe it is there's an old line, I think it was from Viktor Frankl, about, you know, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And I found that by practicing meditation and mindfulness, that space is just a little bit longer. It's a little bit, it has a little bit more space in there for me to sort of think about what's happening before I either react in a certain way or habitually start to sort of think about it in a certain way.
Right. And your anger will arise in that space. And then if you've got enough space in there, then you will realize that you don't have to hold on to it. You know, you don't have to, you know, take the bait and then run with the anger or run with the fear. Give it enough space and it'll pass. And that's what the awareness practice does for you.
Yep. So you wrote a book called A Mindful Nation, How a Simple Practice Can Help Us Reduce Stress, Improve Performance, and Recapture the American Spirit. What eventually, or what originally brought you to mindfulness or meditation? Where was your initial introduction to that?
Well, I trace it back really to growing up Catholic. You know, I went to Catholic school for, you know, 12 or 13 years. I had a lot of people in my life that made it a point to take time to pray the rosary, to meditate, to say their prayers. And that kind of contemplative aspect of life was always valued, you know, growing up. And so I trace it back to that kind of culture that I grew up in with my grandparents praying the rosary, my mom, my football coaches. I would see duck into the chapel at school to say their prayers and meditate and all that stuff. So and then on and off throughout my life, like most people, did it for 2 days and thought, wow, this is great. I can focus more. I can concentrate better. I'm kinder. And then I don't do it for like a year, you know, and then you do it for 3 days and then you don't do it for 6 months. And that went on for, you know, really probably a decade or more. And then I did a 5-day retreat that really kind of expanded my practice or developed a practice into a daily session that I do most every day. And, but it goes back to just these points throughout my life where adults were reinforcing that kind of approach.
Excellent. And so what does, you know, mindfulness is a pretty vague term. I think people interpret it differently. What does mindfulness mean to you?
Being aware is, I think, most fundamental. I do like, John Kabat-Zinn's definition of paying attention on purpose to the present moment without judging it. And I think that's a pretty concise definition of what mindfulness is to me. But I think that the shorter version would be being aware. You know, it's awareness, mindfulness, being aware of what's going on outside of you, being aware of what goes on inside of you. And the more you can cultivate that awareness, the more aware you are, but I think the better decisions you can be, and I think the less stress you have because you notice that things are impermanent, you know, and always in transition. Those emotions, you know, you sit down in a quiet room and it's just you and, you know, your emotions and your mind. You see that, you know, fear can come in for, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever, then it passes and something else comes up and then something else comes up. It depending on what you're thinking about or what's going on in your life, but you start to really become aware of all of that internal dialogue that's happening. So the short answer is awareness.
I assume you have a daily meditation practice that you do sort of a formal period that you think then helps you to be more aware during the rest of the day? Is that how you approach it?
Yeah. You know, I had one in the morning for the longest time, you know, years. And then I got married and had a couple stepkids. And then about 6 months ago, I have a newborn baby. And the baby did not get the memo on my meditation practice. So it's been a little on and off in the last 6 months. But yeah, daily practice normally, quiet time, either on a cushion or sitting in a chair. The breath practice, you know, your mind goes past future. You come back to your breath. I try to do a lot of body work where I just try to ground my mind into my body to, you know, keep it grounded. I mean, you've got a couple of really solid anchors for your mind. That's your breath, which is relatively important to your life, and then your body, which is always with you as well. So if you want to be in the present moment, you know, you can really start practicing being grounded in the things that are always in the present moment. That's your body and your breath.
In your book, you talk a little bit about a moment in your life where you realized that you always had some story going on in your head that you never shared with anybody else and you weren't entirely conscious of, but it had so much to do with always doing things perfectly and, you know, all the time and energy you spent trying to uphold that story in your mind that you sort of missed your life.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, once you have the awareness that you are daydreaming a lot and not present, there's a little bit of regret there to think, you know, I was 35 when I went on that retreat. I, you know, still have plenty of moments of, you know, being distracted and whatnot. But yeah, you know, you realize you're missing your life. You know, you get in a car to drive to work and you arrive at work and you realize, how the hell did I get here? Because you were daydreaming the entire time. Or you're with your kids and your mind's at work, or you're with your grandparents who, you know, are near the end of their life and you are thinking about work or something else. You know, you're not there with them.
Right.
And to me, that's, you know, those are the things you regret. And then you forgive yourself because you didn't know any better. But, you know, ultimately, yeah, I had that feeling of, you know, why didn't somebody teach me this when I was a kid?
One of the things that you have started to do, I know, is try and bring some mindfulness to Congress, or at least certain members of Congress, which strikes me as an overwhelmingly large task and quite a place to remain mindful in. Do you have any stories or anecdotes about how that's been going for you?
Well, it's slow but sure. You know, the more kind of publicity and stuff that I get, the more people are hearing about it. And I have a lot of spouses of members who come and ask me, you know, they want to meet me for lunch. And this guy came up and said, "Hey, my wife wants to meet you for lunch." And I said, "Are you going to be there?" He's, you know, but was into meditation and yoga and wanted to meet me because she read about me in a couple articles. So therefore, the husband is, you know, a little bit more interested now. I had a guy this morning who's, you know, 3-4 term congressman, you know, saw a book I was reading, you know, in the House gym. And said, "Hey, you know, I'm, you know, we've talked about this. I see that book you're reading. I really want a book that can help introduce this to me." So over time, it's been working. We do a session once a week with members of Congress in the House Chapel, and then we do a session a week where we have teachers come in and teach the staff here. So people who are doing meditations with veterans or in hospitals and schools and, you know, in the Marines, for example, we have them come and lead a 30-minute, you know, basically guided meditation for the staff here once a week just to help educate them on how kind of pervasive this is within society now and all these different areas. So we're trying to push it out that way too. But it's, you know, slow but sure, and, you know, we're just trying to create a little space and a little bit of awareness.
Your book is interesting in a lot of ways, but one of them is that you really walk through the ways that mindfulness. I mean, the title was, you know, it's a simple practice.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. This can be really challenging to figure out. And when we try to deal with them on our own, when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I recently had a few things I needed to talk about, and I signed up for BetterHelp again. And I choose it because it's convenient, it's flexible, and it works well with my schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/feed today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/feed. The ways that mindfulness can help in schools, with our emergency responders, with our veterans, with our health system. And so one of the things that you've done as a result of that is you've brought mindfulness education into some of the schools back in your home district in Youngstown. Can you maybe give an update on how that's going?
Yeah, it's going great. I mean, with the teachers are really starting to see the difference, the change in the students, the incidence of misbehavior are down significantly. In fact, one school had no behavioral incidents going into like October of the school year this year. You know, the parents are noticing a difference. I've had, you know, Republican teachers come up to me and said, you know, you're always going to have my vote because, you know, I'm a Democrat. You're always going to have my vote because of what you've done to this school. And, you know, it's a city school in Warren, Ohio, and, you know, mid-sized city, you know, multicultural district, a lot of economic inequality, bad neighborhoods, you know, the whole nine yards. And we went right in there, and they're starting to see a real difference with what we're doing, so I'm super excited about it, and you know, trying to use this as an example of how we can really, you know, shift policy and let others in the state and local communities see, you know, how fundamental it is. I mean, if you're trying to teach a kid and they're not paying attention, what's the use?
Right.
You know, and so we yell at kids to pay attention. And what these practices are teaching the kid how to pay attention instead of just yelling at them to pay attention. And I don't know a parent in America that doesn't want their child to have a higher ability to mobilize their attention span, to have a higher level of focus, to have mental discipline, to have resiliency. A mental resiliency and toughness and the kind of grittiness that leads to success. I mean, these are the kind of things that ultimately are going to be the tools that the kid's going to need when they go out into the real world. And so there's not a better, more fundamental skill set that we can give these kids. And that's why you're seeing this in corporate America. I mean, you're seeing it in the Marine Corps. You're seeing it at Google. You're seeing it at Target. You're seeing it in other corporations. A lot of the Silicon Valley folks are now having embedding into their newer companies mindfulness-type practices and meditation practices because it gives them – the replenishment, the focus, the attention cultivation, the awareness cultivation, the ability to really sit and listen and not be jittery and agitated, but sit down and, you know, with a certain amount of relaxation and solve these problems. It doesn't mean you're soft. It means you're tough. You know, it means you're disciplined. You got mental discipline. And that's why I say in places like Ohio, I can't imagine, you know, a Republican couple in Delaware County in Ohio, or a Democratic, you know, couple in, you know, Northeast Ohio somewhere, both want the same thing for their kids. And I don't know any parent that wouldn't want the school system to start teaching these kids some of these basic skills that are really hurting, they're not hurting, these skills are not being developed because of the technology, because of the TV, because of the iPhone and the iPad and the constant stimulus that they get from all of these things. We've got to push back, and we better come up with some strategies that are going to allow our kids to develop their attention span, cultivate that awareness, and be functioning adults. I mean, a lot of times you look at kids, they don't even look in the eye. You know, they don't look at you because they're looking at their phone, and they're losing the ability to have face-to-face conversations with people. And to me, that is not the direction that we want to go in as a country. And so these practices, to me, you know, if it's good enough for the Marine Corps, good enough for the Seattle Seahawks, good enough for the Chicago Bulls and Los Angeles Lakers and New York Knicks, you know, it's good enough for our kids, and every kid should have the opportunity to learn it.
You said that part about not being soft. We had Dan Harris on the show who wrote a book about mindfulness, the ABC News anchor, and he talks very much about, you know, not losing your edge. And you use some terms in there around grittiness and toughness. And I'm curious what you think, or how you think, because I think that the main thing that meditation has, you know, Dan says meditation has a bad PR problem, right? Which is that it's thought of as this soft thing. And the terms that you're using are really not soft at all.
Nor should they be. I mean, I think we all respect people who have mental toughness, who can get knocked down and get back up. And who can do that? Well, someone who can keep their eye on the ball, have a goal, and go after that goal with all your heart and all your mind, and then you get knocked off track. Inevitably, in life, you're going to get knocked off track. Do you have the ability to stay focused and be resilient enough to stay on track and to get back on track and then keep going? I mean, these are the qualities that we really admire in people. You know, the redemption, you know, the person who gets knocked down and gets back up and stays in the game. These are things that we really appreciate. And in these practices, you know, it's hard to sit still. It's not easy. You know, it's easy to daydream. And I think that some daydreaming is appropriate at times. But, you know, it's not easy to stay focused on your breath, stay in your body. Your mind goes to the past, your mind, and come back and keep coming back and keep coming back. That builds a mental toughness of a tenacity that is needed for you to go out into the world. That's not a soft skill. That's an essential skill that you need, and which is why, you know, the Marine Corps is interested in this stuff, and why athletes are starting to really gravitate towards it. And it's not just being able to stay on track, but also having the awareness of, okay, when do I need to adjust? You know, I'm not putting on a helmet and running into a brick wall with my head just because the wall's in the way. You also have to have some awareness of, okay, I know what the goal is. You know I want to go north, but there's a swamp in front of me. I need to figure out how to navigate that stuff. So you need to be adaptable, but yet keep your eye on the ball or your eye on the goal. And these are the kind of things and qualities and traits that you cultivate while you're doing this that are essential for success in life, and success however you determine it, whatever you want your goals and dreams to be. And, you know, I just feel like in a lot of ways, you know, that I'm in the hopes and dreams business, you know? I mean, like, how do I help young people? How do I help people who are sick get into a mindset to be successful, to do extraordinary things. And I think this practice is really fundamental to doing that, to cultivating that grittiness that you need to succeed.
Yeah, I think that's a fundamental, there's a fundamental misunderstanding about mindfulness or meditation. And it was one that plagued me for a long time. It's that I think I was too focused on what was happening while I was meditating, what my experience was, like, oh, I should be really relaxed, or I should be really happy, or and realizing that it didn't really have anything to do with that. What it had to do with was how it improved the way my mind worked the other 23 and a half hours of the day. And it didn't have to do with being blissed out in that moment, because I rarely am. Right. It had to do with what happened when I got back up and went into my day.
Right, exactly. And that's it. You know, it's taking it off the cushion. It's taking it off the chair. It's, you know, you go to practice during the week for the game. You know, you practice and practice and practice. I mean, the sports analogies to this for me are unbelievably connected. And you practice, and that's why they call it, you know, a meditation practice. So that, you know, it's not it. It's about when you get up and go into the world, do you have a little bit more awareness, a little bit more focus, a little bit more kindness in your heart, a little more softness, you know, off the edge, but still maintaining that kind of grittiness, you know, and it's all right there.
There's a lot of scientific data out there on meditation. You cover a fair amount of it in your book. There's been, you know, it continues to just come out. Do you have a favorite study or two maybe you could share with us about that gives some scientific basis to the benefits of meditation?
Well, I like the one that I write about in for psoriasis patients, which was really interesting. They took a group of people who have psoriasis. And they separated them into two groups. In the one group, one of the treatments for psoriasis is you go into a light box. So they put all this, both groups, into a light box. But the one group they put into a light box, and while they were in the light box, they practiced mindfulness. They came back, and the study said that they needed four times less the treatments than the original group that just went into the light box. So it was so significant, they thought they screwed the study up. So they went back and they did it again, and they got the exact same results, four times less in treatments than the other group. And I love that because it makes a couple of points. The first point is that your body naturally wants to heal itself. You have a problem, it wants to heal itself. If you remove heavy levels of stress, you know, diet's very important as well. But if you remove levels of stress, your body will function properly and try to heal itself. So the stress is what prevents your body from really healing itself in the way that it needs to. And I think that's really important. And the other piece is from the public policy side, which, you know, people's eyes tend to glaze over, but we do have a national discussion about healthcare costs and you know the national debt, which is driven by two healthcare programs in our country: Medicaid, which serves the poor, and Medicare, which serves the elderly. These are the two main drivers of our national debt. So if I'm a policymaker and I look at that study and I say, wow, this person practices mindfulness and go in the light box and needs four times less treatments. How much is it? How many people have psoriasis, and how much is each treatment? And so you take those numbers and you say multiply them and you say, okay, we're going to need four times less. And you start doing the math on this and do the same thing for high blood pressure.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward.
You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
And ulcers and ADD and ADHD and all of these things that I think could be diminished by a mindfulness practice, you start saving real money. And I think it's important for conservatives and liberals to say, well, wait a minute, we want a higher quality of life and we want to spend less on healthcare. Well, here's a practice that's very low cost. There's no side effects. And, you know, what's the harm if you don't think it works? Nothing. But, you know, why not give it a try? Sometimes in Washington, we think, boy, you know, we got this really complicated problem, and if we have a more complicated solution, maybe we can fix it. When the reality is, we need to get back to the fundamentals and start simplifying. And you know, there's nothing more simple than, you know, trying to relax by following your breath.
What are some of the main objections that you come across from, for lack of a better word, I'll just call it mainstream society, to these ideas of mindfulness?
I think there's a general unawareness, really, of what it is and what it does, or even knowing about it. You know, a lot of people don't even know what the hell it is. You know, I mean, it has never crossed their mind. You know, they don't know a whole lot about it, and that's changing a lot more now. You see Dr. Oz talking about it. You see some of these other TV shows are doing stories about it. One of the sports radio and TV shows, when Phil Jackson went to the Knicks, they were talking about it, what he's doing with that organization. A lot of it is people don't know about it, or they have a misunderstanding of what it actually is. Then you have a small group that is convinced that it's, you know, some religious, conspiracy coming from somebody. And then you have the group that knows about it and tries to promote it. So I think there needs to be more of an education campaign. And I think more people learn about it, see about it, hear about it, the more open we'll be. And the real criticism, I think, comes from people who aren't aware. And they say, well, this is some religion. This is Buddhism or something like that.
Right.
And the reality is, this is about awareness. And awareness is a human capability, a human quality, to be aware as a human being. And so to cultivate that awareness, doesn't matter what religion you are. I'm Catholic. I was Catholic before I started doing this. I'm Catholic after I'm afterwards.
Right.
I haven't changed at all. And many people feel like it deepens their religious practice because they're more present. They're in the present moment, experiencing what, God's creation and all the rest. So, the religion thing, I think, is the most that you hear about most, but it's also the most kind of misunderstood. You know, I feel like those folks are don't understand actually what it is.
One of the things I'm always skeptical, and I think people tend to be skeptical of things that sound too good to be true, and sometimes some of this stuff sounds like that. And you had a line in your book that I thought was really good because it was very, very practical and sort of explained meditation or mindfulness here. And I'm going to read it to you. And it says, "Mindfulness won't eliminate the responsibilities and pressures that cause us to become so scattered, but it can help us deal with them in a more effective way."
Yeah. You know, you got a bad back, you know, you go to therapy and you do some exercises, you do some calisthenics, you do whatever, you know, you still got a bad back, but it's different now because you have strengthened some muscles around it, or you relate to it differently. You are better able to kind of deal with it. I think it's the same thing. You know, you still have moments where you're really scattered. You still have fears and anger and joy and everything you attributed to the two different wolves. You still have that. You don't make that go away. You know, people say sometimes I sit and meditate and I just – that the thoughts still keep coming. And it's like, yeah, I mean, they're probably not going to stop for a while. You know, you just got to relate to them differently and recognize that you are not your thoughts. And – you know, you can let them pass. And so I think that is, you know, what I meant, you know, really when I wrote that, it's about having a different relationship, you know, with whatever it is that you're dealing with and not getting caught up and really making matters worse. I mean, we see this a lot when you hurt yourself. You know, you sometimes say, oh, I got a pain in my back. Oh my God, I've had this pain in my back for a couple hours now. You know, my dad has cancer. Maybe it's cancer. You know, you go from A to Z and you create an entire story as opposed to saying, well, I got something in my back. I'm just going to see what it is and ride it out. And of course, you're going to think the worst, let that go. It's okay. You know, we build these stories up and then you stress out about it and it makes matters worse. Instead of having some clarity with what's really happening, which may be nothing, you know, maybe you got a kink in your back, you know?
Exactly. So you wrote another book that maybe we could just spend a couple minutes on before we wrap up here, called The Real Food Revolution: Healthy Eating, Green Groceries, and the Return of the American Family Farm. Can you give us a little overview of the book and what you're trying to impart there?
Well, our country is sick. We have a sick country. We have, in the next few years, half the country is going to have either diabetes or pre-diabetes. We have 1 in 4 teenagers that have either diabetes or pre-diabetes. We weigh 20 more pounds than we did in the 1960s, and we've only grown an inch taller on average. And this is going to be the first generation of Americans that won't live as healthy or as long of a life as their parents. First generation.
Wow.
So we're a sick country right now. And if we want to be competitive economically, we need to be a healthy country. And the system that is currently in place makes really highly processed, bad, fake food, what Dr. Mark Hyman calls food-like substances, really cheap and affordable. So all the people who, you know, aren't making the money they were making and struggling to make ends meet have access to this, you know, cheap food. And we subsidize that with taxpayer money. And this, is, of course, is making us sick, like I said earlier, with the Medicare program, the Medicaid program. And then we subsidize the health care, whether it's through the Affordable Care Act or these other programs, to pay for health care for people who are sick because they're eating cheap food that's highly subsidized and made cheap by the subsidies that the farmers get to grow these kind of crops. It's insane.
Right.
So a real food revolution is about how do we shift those subsidies into creating more access to fresh fruits and vegetables, real food, and therefore driving down our healthcare costs, and how we can do that in urban areas, how we can do that in, you know, all kinds of farming land in places like Ohio, to really reform our food system and our agriculture system.
It is kind of stunning when you dig into the data and learn more about that stuff. I've typically just, until really the last year, not cared too much about diet. I mean, enough to stay relatively healthy, but not paid too much attention to what's really going on. And when you get into some of that stuff, the numbers of, you know, the diabetes, the pre-diabetes, the obesity, it's staggering. And you look at, to your point, the subsidies and the type of food that's widely available. And it's another one of those, it reminds me of what you're saying with mindfulness, that there are some really easy, low-cost solutions out there that is, of course, sometimes why I think that they're not more widely pursued, because there's no real way to make money on them. If you're, you know, the government can save money, but there's no way to make money on them as much in the private sphere, which I think sometimes stops them from getting the momentum they could otherwise.
Yeah, well, that's why, you know, I say we need a revolution. You know, we need an organic, growing, you know, people-powered movement in the country by those very same soccer moms in Delaware County and Ohio or other suburban areas in America that are really concerned that their kids aren't going to be healthy. You know, what are these kids eating in school? And I know people say, you know, well, what's the cost of changing the system? Well, what's the cost of not saving the system or changing the system? The cost is your kid is not going to live as long as you did for the first time in the history of our country. I mean,
That's amazing.
And so, you know, we're going to know the cost of anything the cost of everything and the value of nothing. And, you know, if we value our kids' health, if we want to be competitive, I mean, here's the thing. We only have 313 million people in America. Our kids that graduate from our high schools and our colleges and our community colleges are competing with China, 1.3 or 4 billion people, or India, 1.3 or 4 billion people. We only have 313 million. You know, we better be ready to kick some butt, and we better be healthy and have a focus, a concentration, mental discipline, physical discipline, creativity, awareness of what's going on and changes in the economy. We better be innovative. You can't do that if you're sick. You know, you can't do that with diabetes, with everybody having type 2 diabetes. You just can't do it. You can't do it with the sick workforce. You can't do it with the sick country. And the reality of it is, we better fix this, and we better fix it fast, or we're going to continue to fall behind in our healthcare system. It's going to collapse on its own weight, because there's no way, if half the country has diabetes, we're going to spend our entire federal budget on taking care of people that are sick with, you know, these things that come from eating highly processed food and these food-like substances that they just add sugar and fat and salt to them, where if you didn't add it, it would be cardboard. Can't have it, you know. And the levels of sugar in some of these products are unbelievable. We just sent a letter to the FDA saying that they should change. If you look on the back of a product, it'll say grams of sugar in there. Well, nobody knows what the hell a gram of sugar is. You know, I don't. I don't think anybody else does. So we said convert that to teaspoons. So for every 4 grams is 1 teaspoon. Now you go and you try to even get yogurt, and there's 22 grams of sugar in there, which is like 5 teaspoons of sugar. So would you give your kid 5 teaspoons of sugar, you know, and say this is healthy? So we've got to help the consumer to try to understand this. And I'm just saying, like, we've got to do something. I'm not a prude. The first story in my book is that I'm addicted to chicken wings and ice cream. I mean, I love it. You know, I love to watch football and eat chicken wings and have a glass of beer and every now and again have some ice cream. I'm just saying, you can't do that every single day, and you can't eat and drink gallons of pop and expect to be healthy. And what's happening now is we're sick, and we've got to change it. We've got to change it now.
I agree 100%. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our time, Tim, but thanks so much for being on the show. I am very proud to be an Ohioan and have you as one of our congressmen.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people in Ohio and across the country that are interested in these issues, and I look forward to hopefully we can, you know, build an army across the country that can help change the policies in Washington and in our state capitals across the country to bring about some real change for the sake of our kids.
Well, thank you so much. We'll talk again soon. Bye.
Thank you.
You can learn more about this podcast and Tim Ryan at oneufeed.net/Tim Ryan.